This is a Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on February the 4th, 2000. Our speaker is Bob B. of Aptos, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA members at the public level. Thank you.
My name's Bob, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
I'm moving around here, because if I stand back there, you can't see me. It's, you know. It's just awesome being here tonight, and I'm happy to see there's a few people from Santa Cruz here. I'm from Aptos. But the reason I'm invited here tonight is that I started, my roots are here in the Valley. I did most of my drinking in the Valley, and that was a long time ago, I'm happy to say. But it's funny, the more time that goes by, the more I remember it. And my attitude now is that I'm a product of a bunch of miracles. And I know many, if not most of you, feel the same way. To me, it's not a minor, but a major miracle that I'm standing here at all. Because the way I was drinking, I was well on my way to being dead. And that was like 25 years ago, so, you know. I used to be, by the way, 6'4" and weighed 180 pounds. You know, just you settle as you get older. It's also a miracle that I'm standing here speaking at an AA meeting. Let me see if I can explain that. About 25 years ago, I had just started in the program, and I was just beginning to experience the magic of AA. And I had the opportunity at a meeting to stand up and talk. And part of my job, the kind of job I did on a day-to-day basis, was speaking to groups, so it was kind of easy for me. And somebody heard me when I stood up at a meeting and talked. So after a couple of meetings, somebody said, well, we have a speaker meeting down the road. Why don't you come and speak at it? And I didn't know any better. I was kind of a rim runner at that time in AA. You know, I was not really into it. I was just running around the edges. But I wasn't drinking, and that was good. And this person said, we have a speaker meeting down the street. Why don't you come and speak at it? And I said, oh, okay. What does that mean? He said, well, you speak, right? You know, tell us about your experiences. So I did. I went to that speaker meeting, and I spoke for an hour. And I went away. And somebody at that meeting came up later on and said, that was pretty good. How about speaking at another meeting? And I spoke, I think, at two or three meetings in those early days, like 25 years ago. And at about the third meeting when I finished my talk, and I can't tell you that I can remember anything about it at this point, a gentleman came up to me, and he's a gentleman that still haunts the halls of AA around here. His name is Bud T. Some of you may know him. Bud T. came up to me after the meeting. He shook my hand, and he said, that was pretty good. And I said, thank you very much. He looked at me, looked me right in the eye, and he said, let me ask you something. He said, do you have a sponsor? And I said, well, no. And he gave me a real piercing stare, and he said, get one. And it kind of shook me to my shoes. You know, somebody really blew my cover at that point. I didn't even have a cover to blow, but, you know, anyhow. It shook me so much that I have to tell you, I never spoke at another meeting again as a speaker for 25 years until tonight, as far as I can remember. So if this doesn't go well, it's Bud T's fault, because I'm going to try again. And I'm happy to tell you that I'm trying to do this safely. I got my sponsor sitting in the back, and he's taking notes, and he's going to tell me what I said wrong after the meeting. So we'll hope it goes well. I think that the only way I can share with you properly is to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. For me, that's a it's a fairly long story, but I'm going to try and cut it down for you. I'm just delighted with there's a lot of new people here tonight, and to me that's wonderful, because to me that's the essence of AA. That's what keeps us going, is the new people that come in here, because I can look back and remember when I was a new person, and I don't know, having the new people and the new blood, and the thing keeps moving along and the magic continues to happen. I was a kind of a bizarre drunk. I was, it says up on the board there that I was Dr. Bob in the play. Did anybody in here see that play that we did? Oh, good. Okay, thank you. That's good. That gives me a little frame of reference. So I had the name Dr. Bob in the play. I also have a little fishing boat, and the people go fishing, and they call me Captain Bob. When I first came into the program in Los Gatos, they called me High Bottom Bob. And I have a few other names that I'll get into later on, but I got a whole series of them. I did my drinking in Los Gatos, and I was, I thought of myself for a long time as kind of a candy ass drunk. And the reason I thought that way was I kept a steady job, with a corporation, you know, and things were going along swimmingly. I had the nice little house and a wife and three children and all the accoutrements that go with that. And I thought my life was real successful. There was just one little thing wrong. And I thought it was because my wife was going bad on me. You know, I mean, she had become a fundamentalist religious person, and that drove me crazy. And so to make it easier for me to put up with that, I drank a little bit. Well, I learned later on that wasn't the real truth at all. The real truth was that I drank a little bit, and then everything went from there. But what I did was I would get drunk every night, 7 nights a week. I was a pattern drinker in the sense I was not a binge drinker. I drank very specific times and very specific amounts, except that amount kept getting a little bit larger as time went on until I stopped. I used to go to, do you know where, is there still a King's Court liquor store over in Los Gatos? Anybody know? There's a shopping center over there off of Los Gatos Boulevard. There used to be a King's Court liquor store over there. I used to go in there about every 2 weeks and buy a case of gin. Now, back in those days, gin was my drink. I drank martinis in the early days. In my later drinking, I just put gin over ice because you don't want to screw around with all that other stuff because it takes too long to get the job done. And so I just drank straight gin. But I used to go into the King's Court liquor store about every 2 weeks and buy a case of gin because I discovered with my incredibly brilliant mind that if you bought a quart of booze rather than a fifth, it was a little cheaper. And if you bought a half gallon, it was even a little cheaper yet. And then I discovered that if you bought a case of half gallons, you not only got a cheaper price on the half gallon, but you got 5% off on the case. And so I was saving so damn much money, it was incredible. One day when I went into the liquor store and bought my case of gin, honest to God, I can't believe it, a case of half gallons. I was writing a check for the guy, and he, by that time he knew me. He said, "How are you, Bob?" I said, "I'm fine, good to see you again, you know, I'll write my check." He said, "Man, you must have a lot of parties." He really said that, "You must have a lot of parties." And you know, it just sent a little chill up my spine. It didn't stop me, but it sent a little chill up my spine because you people know the truth. I wasn't having any parties. That gin was for me. It wasn't even for my wife. She drank a little bit of bourbon, but not, you know, not much. She was a penny waste drinker. That gin was for me. I drank every damn bit of it. And not too many years ago, I was going through some old papers and throwing stuff away, and I just happened to riffle through a handful of old canceled checks, and I found a stack of checks. I found a series of checks that were written during the last year of my drinking. And it was a whole series of checks written to this liquor store for cases of gin. And it was amazing because I was able to take those checks, look at the dates, and figure out exactly what I was purchasing and therefore what I was drinking, because it was all for me. And I could do a simple arithmetic and discover what it was I was drinking because I drank in that set pattern. Well, what that did to me was turn me into a drunk. I was a drunk before that, but that was the final years, the last years of my drinking, and I became a total drunk every night, fall down drunk. But I didn't go out and get in trouble. I was a little too small to get in fights. Couldn't do that. Well, I'd fight with my wife a little bit. I had occasion to kick the cat over the back fence a couple of times. And if you hate cats, that's cool. I happen to love cats, so that shows you what alcohol can do to you. And I always remember that years after that, even when I looked at the cat like that, the cat would run and hide because it was afraid I was going to kick it over the back fence again. So I used to do things like that. I tended to fall down. My wife would try and put me to bed, but she finally gave up on that and just let me lay there. And I'd wake up in the middle of the living room floor in the middle of the night. The thing that about my pattern of drinking that was peculiar was that I did it every night, 7 nights a week. And then somehow I'd get up in the morning, clean myself up, and go to work and do my job. One day at work, a friend of mine came in, and I had a meeting with some kind of executive or something. And a friend that was working with me came in and said, "Hold out your hand." I held out my hand, and the friend put a roll of certs in my hand, lifesavers. And I said, "What the hell is that for?" And they said, "You smell like a brewery." It never happened to me before. And it really kind of shook me up because I didn't think I did. I didn't drink during the day. I was sober during the day, right? I only drank at night. Well, you know the problem. I drank so much at night that was coming out of my pores during the day. It was just coming out of all over my body, my breath, my skin. And I was gradually becoming a pretty sick person. That went on for several years. My drinking history went on for probably 25 years, but the worst part of it, as it tends to get, it got worse and worse and worse until during the last 3 to 5 years I was drinking the way I just described. But somehow I managed to go to work every day. My wife didn't leave me. I didn't lose my job. It's a wonder. And I want to tell you, as briefly as I can, what happened in the what happened part of the story, because I think that's kind of interesting, and I hadn't thought about it for a while, and it'd be nice to think about it again. I was chugging along fat, dumb, and happy. I knew that my life was in some sort of turmoil, but I thought my relationship with my wife had broken down, and the job stress was getting high, and the kids were driving me crazy. As a matter of fact, I had a list of things that were driving me crazy that would take about 20 minutes to lay on you, and I laid it on people as anytime I had a chance. But none of that list included alcohol, because my assumption was that I drank because of these other things, right? That's a perfectly normal attitude, and that's the way I looked at it. In the company where I worked, they instituted a health screening kind of program. It was fairly new in those days. I think it's fairly common now. But this was a periodic health screening they did with employees just to do a general checkup on their health. And I had reached the exalted age of 45, and I was due for a fairly thorough health screening. And so they had me fill out a long questionnaire. And the one part of the questionnaire, it said, do you drink alcohol? And I put yes, because I considered myself an honest person. And they said, how much? And I put, you know, 2-3 drinks a day, because I considered myself an honest person. Of course, I didn't tell them that those were the biggest glasses I had, full of gin. And it wasn't really 2 or 3, it was like 5 or 6, you know, whatever I could drink until I fell down. I didn't tell them that. But anyhow, when I finished the questionnaire, the way the procedure worked in this particular company was the questionnaire was reviewed by a nurse who looked for any anomalies in the questions. And then if she saw any anomalies, you were sent to see the doctor. Well, unbeknownst to me, the nurse that reviewed the anomalies, or reviewed the questions, had quite a bit of experience and background in the field of alcoholism. And so when I sat down with her and she went through the questions and looked at them, and she looked at me and she played a trick on me. I went to see her. My appointment to see her was about 10 o'clock in the morning. Now, I described my drinking pattern to you. You can imagine what condition I was in the morning, even though I got up and went to work. I was just barely functioning, just barely functioning. I suffered badly from a number of maladies, perhaps the worst of which was something called peripheral nephritis, which just means that my hands shook all the time. I shook so badly I couldn't sign my name. I had all kinds of excuses for it. I hurt my wrist, I did this, I did that. But I shook all the time. I would have died for a cup of coffee in the morning, but I couldn't do it because I shook so bad I couldn't pick it up. This particular nurse, when she was talking to me and going over the questionnaire, she looked at me and she she pegged me immediately. Just by looking at me, she pegged me. I didn't know that. But she said to me, she said, would you like a cup of coffee? And I said, no thanks. I don't drink coffee in the morning. I have one cup before I leave home, and I don't drink anymore, you know. Came up with my usual excuse. She said, excuse me. And she went out, and she came back with two cups of coffee, one for herself, and she set one down in front of me. And she watched me. I found out later. She just did it to torture me. I hated her for it. I wanted that coffee so bad, but I couldn't pick it up. And so we talked for a while, and she went over some of the questions. Then she excused herself, and she came back, and she said, the doctor would like to talk to you for a moment. Would that be all right? And I said, yeah, that'd be all right. I had had some blood tests done prior to that, by the way. And unbeknownst to me, my liver function had come back badly impaired. I was in serious physical trouble. So the doctor called me in. And I'm always in awe of physicians. To this day, I'm in awe of physicians. The white coat does something for me. The wood panel walls on the office. You know, I walked in, sat down, and the doctor looked at me, and he said, by the way, I found out that this doctor, very rare situation, also had substantial background in the field of alcoholism. I didn't know that. The doctor looked at me and said, you're not looking too well. You feeling all right? And I said, well, I'm under quite a bit of stress. And he said, why don't you tell me about it? You know, feel free. Tell me what's bothering you. Well, that was all I needed. I spent the next, I spent the next 30 minutes telling him about all of the things that were wrong in my life, my job, the family, the kids, everything, you know, all the problems. And I went on and on and on, and he listened to me, never said a word. Let me wind all the way. I got all done until it was all out. And he just sat there. And I stopped. And he looked at me and he said, is that it? And I said, yeah. He said, are those all of your problems? And I said, yeah. And he said, bullshit. Exactly like that. And it really unglued me. It really did. Because I, you know, in this atmosphere, the white coat and the professionalism, and this guy looking at me saying bullshit, It really took me aback, and I got all flustered, and I said, excuse me? And he said, bullshit! Didn't you hear me the first time? And I was so unglued, I started to bubble up, and I got terribly defensive, and I didn't know what to do. But I really couldn't do anything. I couldn't really function at that time. And he let me sort of sit there and bubble for a little while. And then he said, now, listen to me. He said, I'm going to tell you one time what's wrong with you, because you've got it completely backwards. And I got really upset. I got terribly upset. He said, you've got it backwards. I'm going to tell you one time what your problem is and what you can do about it, and that's it. And he explained to me what my problem was. He said, you're going to die. He said, I can look in your eyes. They're yellow. He said, you're shaking. He said, your liver function test came back badly impaired. He said, you're suffering from alcoholism, and it's going to kill you. And you got to do something about it. And if you don't do something about it, you're going to die. It's that simple. Well, no one in my life had ever said anything like that to me before, because I had gone along for years and years just functioning away and chugging along. And I had no idea, and it completely unglued me. And I said, well, I can't. I got a bunch of meetings I have to go to in the next couple of days. And he said, I've told you the situation. You have to make the decision. I said, well, what can I do? He said, I want you to go into a recovery hospital today. And I said, you've got to be kidding. I mean, my life had come to an end. I'd never heard that before. I said, I can't do it. He said, I can't help you then. Either you take action and do something, or get out of my office. You know. And he kicked me out. He threw me out. And I was devastated. I was totally devastated. It was classic intervention, long before the term had even been invented. I didn't even know what it was. But this guy turned out to be an expert. And I walked away thinking, well, I can't do that. 2 days later, I decided I had to do something. And so I called him and said, I'm ready to go. And I went into the hospital's no longer there. There's a little hospital down in Morgan Hill called Montevilla Hospital, and funky little place. And I said, okay, I'll go. So I went down there and I checked myself in. And that was an awesome experience. Any of you that have ever been to any kind of recovery hospital, when you walk in the door and you hear the lock click behind you, like you're locked in, you know. If that's never happened to you before, it sort of takes you aback, and it's kind of bad. But I went through a 4-week program down there, and I learned two things. One, I learned that that I probably was an alcoholic. And the second thing I learned was I absolutely hated Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, of course, any program like this, you're immediately exposed to AA. The first night I was there, I was dragged down the hall, almost literally, and I found myself in my first AA meeting. And there were many people from the surrounding community that came to those meetings. And here were all these bright-eyed, happy, smiling people. I was not bright-eyed. I was not happy. I was not smiling. I was not happy to be there. I was really pissed off at the world and everything else. And here were all these people, can you believe it? Standing in a circle, holding hands, and saying the Lord's Prayer. And I was just infuriated. And I swore to God I would never go anywhere near one of those meetings again. And I went through 4 weeks of that program, and I met some interesting people. Now, in the time I have with you this evening, I'm going to make some reference to references to two things that are important that I want you to remember. If you don't remember anything, I'm going to make some reference to God, and I'm going to make some references to people, because to me the two things that happen in Alcoholics Anonymous are that as you get into this program, at least this is what my experience has been, you will encounter people that will change your life. That's what happened to me. And the other thing you will encounter as you encounter these people is you will begin to encounter God as you understand Him. Or, if I can put it another way, you will begin to experience a higher power. Those are the two things that happened to me. And neither one of them happened easily. Because I was not a religious person when I went in there. I'm still not a religious person. And the concept of God was foreign to me and not very pleasant to me. The first thing that happened to me in this little hospital, though, was that I ran into some people. And I have to tell you about one of them, because it's very important. His name was Jack. I was put into a room, and there was an empty bed next to me. But there was nobody in it when I went in there. I found out later that the reason nobody was in it was the guy that was coming into it was in the detox ward, because he had come in horizontal. He had come in close to death. He weighed about 80 pounds when he came in the door. They carried him in. They put him in a special room until he was able to stand up. Then they brought him down and put him in the room with me. And we were roommates for the next 4 weeks. And I got to know him, obviously, extremely well. This was the first person that was put in my life. I know now he was put in my life. I didn't then. At the beginning of my recovery. And I discovered some interesting things happened. Jack turned out to be one of the most brilliant people I've ever met in my life. I had to be the most brilliant person. I mean, I can't begin to describe to you how smart this guy was. I mean, just literally, he had like 4 different college degrees. He had a medical degree. He had a PhD in biophysics or some damn thing like that. And he had a couple other degrees. He worked at Ames Laboratory in the field of deep space medicine. Okay, this bizarre stuff. This is back in 1973. Okay, this guy knew more about chemistry. Oh, he had a degree in chemistry too. I told him gin was my drink, you know. And he said in the lab they used to synthesize gin. They'd make their own gin. They'd add the juniper berries. He said we made the best gin you ever tasted. Jack turned out to be a complete drunk. But he knew everything. He knew the molecular structure of alcohol. He knew exactly what it did to your body. The guy was brilliant. When we graduated from that program, we all voted him most likely to succeed. Because he was so smart, right? And we parted. When I left the program, we went our own way. By the way, he had already lost his family. His wife had divorced him. He had 2 children. And because he couldn't stay sober. Anyhow, he went back to his job, but he sure was brilliant. He tried to get out one time in the middle of the program because he was supposed to go to the USSR and present a paper on deep space medicine at some conference. It's just awesome. Okay, now, I've saved this, and it's interesting. I went to see if I still had it, and by golly, I did. I got it. See how yellow that is? Here's a clipping from the newspaper. I haven't looked at this for a long time. This was in 1973 that I was in that hospital, and Jack came into my life. When I got out of the hospital, we all left the hospital saying, hey, this guy, Jack, I mean, if any of us are going to make it, Jack's going to make it because he knows what's going on, right? He knows what's going on. I went home and a couple of months went by, and one evening, as was my habit, I was sitting and reading the newspaper, and in those days I was a young man. And I never read the obituaries like I do today. Now you read the obituaries, by the way, because you've got to see, you know, who's made it, who you're beating and who you're not beating, something like that. But in those, anyhow, that evening, for some reason that I still don't understand, I do understand, for some reason my eye lit on the obituary page in the paper. Just, this was so long ago, by the way, this is San Jose News, so it wasn't even the Mercury News. Monday, November 5th, 1973, it says, Dr. Jacob Blank, 47, noted AIMS scientist dies. And that is a headline, right? And it popped out at me. And I thought, wait a minute, is that Jack? You know, it said Jacob, and I thought, but AIMS caught my eye. And then I started to read it. It said, Dr. Jack Blank, Jacob Blank, an Ames Research Center scientist who had devised a method to convert breath into life-sustaining sugar for long space flights, has died of an apparent heart attack. He was 47, stricken in his Los Altos home on Saturday. He was preparing only last week, publicists had been preparing a major article on his work. He'd been with NASA for 10 years, yada, 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 long article about him. Native of New Bedford, Massachusetts, leaves his children and a brother, and he's gone. I ran to the phone, and I called the doctor that I had gotten to know pretty well from the hospital. And I said, Russ, I told him who it was. I said, what happened to Jack? And there was a pause on the phone, and he said, you know what happened to Jack. And I said, you're kidding me. He said, no, he went back. And he stayed sober for about a day, and he started drinking again, and it killed him. And you know what that taught me? That taught me that if anybody as smart as Jack could die from alcohol, then I sure had a good shot at it, unless I stayed sober. And Jack was the first person that was put in my life that made that kind of an impact that stays with me today. And that's why I keep that article, because I read it every once in a while. He was quite a guy, quite a guy. But it made me realize, of course, how powerful this thing is that had me by the short hairs, and it made me realize that I had to do something about it. And I really didn't know what to do. I was in kind of a quandary. I was taking some medicine that kept you from drinking. I've forgotten the name of it now. Do they still do that? Anybody? Did they still do that anymore? Anybody do that? I don't know. Anyway, I was taking Antabuse, but that doesn't really keep you sober. It keeps you from drinking. As one guy said in the hospital, he said, man, it sure makes you sick. Think about that. So I was just sort of getting dry, you know, getting dry. I refused to go to AA because I hated it. The only thing I did at the recommendation of the doctors at this hospital was stay close to what we called our little alumni group. There was a small group of us that kind of graduated at the same time, and it turned out that most of the other people in this little group were ladies that were housewives from the Saratoga area, and we had what we called the little alumni group. Well, I didn't know it then. Later on, I realized what we were having was our own little mini AA meeting, but I didn't think of it that way, you see, and we did it kind of informally, and I used to go to that group, and those women started to badger me. And they had already, this little group of women had broken into the St. Luke's meeting in Los Gatos some time before. I like to think of them now as the Ladies of St. Luke's. That was an all-men's meeting. It wasn't a men's meeting, but it was all men. And these ladies, they busted down the doors, and they went in, and they kind of eventually took over the meeting. And one day, one of the closer friends coerced me into going to that meeting. I said, all right, I'll get you off my back, I'll go. And I went to the meeting. And that was the first time I found out what I know you people have found out in these meetings, and that is that you can feel the love in these rooms. It hadn't happened to me before, because I was so full of anger. But the anger was gradually going away as the alcohol went away. And they dragged me to the St. Luke's meeting, and somebody gave me a hug, and I started coming back. And I came back from that point on, and I haven't had a drink since. That was a wonderful meeting for me. And other people came into my life, including the man that became my sponsor. One of the ladies that came into my life at that meeting, a lovely lady named Gail, maybe the second meeting I went to there, I had the opportunity to stand up and speak, and I got up and I started talking about all of the things that were wrong in my life, you know, my problems. And I went on like that for a while, and she was a very forceful woman. And at some point where I stopped to take a breath, she said, "Poor baby." And that was good for me, you know. That was good for me. I became known as Poor Baby for a while. And then at another meeting, I heard a fellow speak named George. And George had the most horrendous story I ever heard in my life. I mean, George had been like the president of the International Hells Angels organization. He had tattoos all over his body. He killed two or three people. He'd been in prison. He'd done it all, you know. And I'd never done anything. I was a complete candy ass. All I did was sit in the corner and get drunk. And so then I got a chance to stand up, and I said, geez, I could never match what George did. You know, that was a terrible mistake, because then I became known as High Bottom Bob. And that stuck with me for a few years. The St. Luke's meeting did a lot for me. One of the things that I learned in St. Luke's was that to learn about the nature of AA, what Alcoholics Anonymous will do to your life if you hang around. Okay? And John C. had to do with one night I went to the St. Luke's meeting. John C. and another guy, this was a big meeting then. It was it's always 100 people now, but there were close to 100 people that night. John C. and another guy hauled in this guy that they had just gone to work on. They brought him into the meeting, and he was drunk as a skunk. And they sat down with him, and the meeting preliminaries started in. The secretary did the opening to the meeting, and there was as there often is, as the meeting began, there was a little quiet moment. And when it got quiet in the room, all of a sudden the drunk that was with John and the other guy, in a real loud voice, said, "Alcoholics Anonymous is a great big pain in the ass." And everybody in the room fell on the floor. And you know why? Because he was right. He was right. Here was this poor guy. He was just trying to be drunk, right? And what does he end up in? He ends up in an AA meeting. So it was screwing up his drinking. The guy was, he had wisdom beyond belief. And we all laughed like hell. Then the room quieted down. It went on a few minutes more, and there was another moment of quiet. And he said it again. At that point, John C., who in those days was known for having a little bit of a short fuse, but I know that's all mellowed out now. He said it again, and John and the other guy picked him up and dragged him out into the patio area where they had their own little meeting, and that went on. So I learned from something. I learned something profound there. If you hang around this organization and you don't embrace it, it will become a great big pain in the ass. Because it will never go away. You know, I mean, once you experience this, you've got to come back. But I tell you, the other half of that is if you stay here and you keep coming back, the miracles will happen to you as they have happened to me. It's been an awesome ride, I'll tell you. It's been an awesome ride. I could spend a long time telling you about what's happened, but I'm going to shorten it to just a couple of things that I want to tell you about. One of the things that happened was, and this falls into the people area again, but before I get to that, I said a little while ago that I'm not a religious person, and that's true. It was worse than that. I had a lot of animosity toward organized religion, toward God as a concept or an entity when I came into this program because of my own personal experiences up to that point. And so I was very resistant to the spiritual side of the program. And then things started to happen. Jack happened to me. My first meeting at St. Luke's happened to me. The love that's in these rooms happened to me. And then some very strange things started to happen in my life. I started to get well physically. And I started to realize that some of the specific things that were happening in my life were beyond the realm of accident. And I believe that today with all my heart, that those things, the things that were happening to me, were not accidents, that they were happening to me by something outside of myself. Call it what you will. I choose to call it God today, and it seems to work for me. And so that's the way it's working for me today. Very specifically, I want to relate to the play just for a second, because that was an incredible experience for me. I hope we can do it again sometime, and I hope many of you get a chance to see it, because it's a wonderful play and it's a wonderful story. But I want to tell you a little bit about it, not to tell you about the play, but to tell you about my experience, because that's what's important to me. I got sober, and time went by. I retired from my job, and I got another little part-time job with a company. And one of the guys I met in the company, this little company, was not somebody I particularly wanted to be a friend with, because he was not my type at all. He had long hair, rode a motorcycle. He was from New York. He was kind of rough-spoken. He's kind of a pain in the butt, you know, from my standpoint. But I discovered in working with him that he was in AA. And I said, well, I'm in AA too. And that was a common bond that kind of got us together. And next thing I knew, we're going fishing together, and we became pretty good friends. And strange things happened, because he said, well, what are you doing now that you're retired? And I said, well, I'm not doing much of anything. I'm sitting around and fish a little bit and just... I'm sort of just a pest around the house. He says, well, I go to an acting workshop in San Jose. He said, why don't you come with me? I said, well, what do I want to do that for? And he said, well, you told me in school you used to be an actor. And I said, oh, that was 50 years ago, you know. He said, wouldn't you like to do it again? I said, well, I thought about it, but I'm too old. He said, no, come with me. Talk me into it. So I did it just for a lark. And I went to this acting workshop in San Jose just to have something to do. And I had done that sort of thing in high school and college, but had put it aside. You know, you go and in my generation, you went in the military, and then you got married, you got a job and all that stuff, and that had been another part of my life. But I had always loved it, and I started to do this again, and I really enjoyed it. So I'm telling the story about a guy that's walking in the door right now here. Hey, Bill, nice of you to drop by.
I want to be here for the good part.
Hey, come here.
Give me a hug. No.
This is Bill W. in the play.
Okay. Are we going to hug or not?
No, we're not going to hug. Because you flustered me because I don't know where I was in the story. It doesn't matter. Your timing is impeccable.
Thank you.
So he says, you know, come to the workshop. So I did. And you know, I loved it because I had never gotten over that the thrill of doing that. That's a goofy thing to do, but it was a lot of fun. And I was in a bunch of little plays with this acting workshop in San Jose, and that really turned me on. But I live in Aptos, and I kept driving back and forth across the hill. And after about 4 years of going back and forth across the hill, I told my wife, I said, geez, I love doing that, but I can't commute like that. I'm too old for this crap. I gotta stop. Maybe I can get connected in San Jose, in Santa Cruz. And this is the true story. Absolutely true, I swear to you. I said, I'm going to stop going to the workshop. And I did. I talked to the guy that ran it, and I said, I've got to quit. He said, okay. So I went home, and I said, I've got to do something, see if there's anything going on in Santa Cruz. And I opened there's a Friday supplement to the newspaper that lists activities, community activities, including theater activities. And I opened it up, and there was a little box in the paper, and said, auditions. It said, Bill W. and Dr. Bob. Okay. And I had 20 years in AA at that point. And I thought, Bill W. and Dr. Bob, it said the play to be produced in Santa Cruz. This is 1996. Said auditions are in such and such a date. And I thought, holy mackerel, I would die to work in a show like that. I would, you know, I'll sweep the floors, take any kind of bit part I can get. So I thought, I'll go down and audition. Well, I had been going to this workshop in San Jose for 4 years, so I was completely equipped. You know, I knew, I mean, in terms of the tools you need to be an actor, I had a headshot picture, had a resume, had all this stuff, right? I had a monologue, so I didn't even think about it, but I was pretty well set up. I go down to the auditions, I do the number, and the director shook my hand and said, well, we'll be in touch, the usual thing, and I go away. The next day, the phone rings, and the director said, how much of a commitment can you make to this production? And I said, whatever is required. He said, well, I'd like you to be Dr. Bob. I just about died. I couldn't believe it. Dr. Bob. And so we went into rehearsal, and we did the play in Santa Cruz at Actors Theater, if you've ever been over there. We did 20 performances, and it was the thrill of a lifetime to do it. Not because of the acting particularly, but the audiences, everybody in the audience was either in a 12-step program or knew somebody in a 12-step program. And it was a touching story. It's the most incredible story I've ever heard. And so I got to do it over there. On the last performance, my sponsor finally shows up, bless his heart, and says, holy mackerel, we got to do this thing in San Jose. And I said, well, the cast here is, you know, they're gone, so you've got to start all over again. So he said, well, how do you do that? And I said, you need a producer. He said, I'll be a producer. What does a producer do? And I said, you're going to find out. So that was we did the show over here in San Jose at West Valley College 2 subsequent years. And it was a thrilling experience. A thrilling experience. The story of what happened to those two guys in 1935 when they met and discovered that they could keep each other sober, and then they could keep 2 or 3 other people sober, is the most inspiring story that I've ever run into. 5 years later, they had written a book, and there were 100 members in the organization, right? And a few years later, there were 1,000 members, and today it's millions of members all over the world, and it's an extraordinary story. But from a personal standpoint, why did I end up doing that play? Well, I ended up doing that play because I got sober. I got into this organization. And the people in this organization and the spiritual strength of this organization got somehow into my heart. And that's why those things happened. I have no question in my mind. No question in my mind at all. That all those things happened just like clockwork. Today, I'm no longer surprised at the miracles that occur in my life. And believe me, when you've had as all the strange physical things happen to me that have happened to me in the last few years, and I'm still standing here, that's a miracle in itself. But I have developed some kind of strange serenity that I don't understand. Must have something to do with this program. Must have something to do. I don't know what it is. But I am able to face some pretty strange adversity and still kind of just muddle through. It doesn't really bother me that much, you know? And the reason it doesn't bother me that much is that I am relatively happy today. I haven't had a drink in 26 and a half years, but I can remember what that gin tasted like. I can still remember what it tasted like. And I don't want to do that anymore. I was talking to a baby of mine in Santa Cruz today. He went out for his first adventure by himself, and he told me what it was like riding on the airplane when they came by with the booze. He was by himself. I told him to be awful careful, and he was okay. But he said, "Man, it was scary because you can taste it, you know." And you got that little bitty obsession person standing on your shoulders, Bob Smith says. And every once in a while he leans over and whispers in your ear and says, you know, you're probably okay now. You can have one drink. Well, that's just bullshit, as you know. It doesn't work that way. And this is the place to be. I thank you for the love in these rooms. I thank you for the love that I can feel tonight. And I thank you for listening to my strange story. I want to close. You haven't quite gotten away from me yet. I mentioned a lady named Gail in earlier on that was she was the lady that said "poor baby" when I told my about all my sad stories. Dear Gail, she used to read this all the time. So in memory of Gail, I want to read the same thing because it's just a paragraph, but it kind of sums up how I feel toward the people in these rooms. It's the end of a vision for you, you know. Page 164 in the old book. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right. And great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you very much.